Namaste, Shalomar Shakatak. Clinton Baptiste here, clairvoyant, medium and psychic, international man of the paranormal, saying welcome to I Am The Egg Pod. Now, for those of you, and I know some people have shied away because of the England football match. I want you to know those people who are still here, you're not missing anything. As I say, I'm a clairvoyant. We're going to lose. 3-1. So you've made the right decision to turn up. Enjoy the show. Thank you.
Obviously, I'm not Chris, I'm Rob, and my job here is to introduce Chris. But right, so I'm Rob Manuel, and a couple of you might know me from some of my rubbish projects like Beta and Fesshole, and that I got involved in Chris's egg pod thing. But I wanted to say a few words about Chris first, okay? I like pacing around, so I'm going to pace. What I love about Chris is his sense of mischief, right? Because I knew Chris, like, for over 20 years, and I knew him through the funny things that he contributed to the Beta website. And I'll give you three examples of the stuff he did before he did this egg pod. He pulled off international headlines. This is not a joke. He pulled off international headlines pretending to be a monkey-based superhero in Tunbridge Wells. And that they would go around doing good deals. And he got all the papers to cover this. It was absolutely mad. The second thing he did that blew my mind was that him and all his mates from work, they got into this thing where they sent dozens of letters to the local paper, the Kent and Sussex Courier, about dog poo. He wanted to see how many variations of the term dog poo would get printed. Thankfully, they all were, apart from the one that said, dog expelled stuff from its anus. I've got this one here that I want to talk about. I've got to turn my page here, very awkwardly, because it is just absolutely extraordinary, Chris's sense of humour. Right, this here, what this is, these are small ads in a paper from 2009. Chris took it on himself to just absolutely send in tons of mad shit to the small ads. I'll read a couple of them. Bare anus. Ideal towel holder. I've thoroughly scrubbed it with Dettol, so don't get uppity. £1. There's so much of it. It's bear tail, perfect replacement ingredient for oxtail soup. £3. This is who Chris is. This is the Chris you don't know that I'm telling you about. But he is that person. He's so funny. So basically, I love Chris's sense of fun. So when he said he wanted to start a Beatles podcast, I knew he would be brilliant. And I said, could I be the first guest? And Chris said yes. And the podcast at the time didn't even have a name. Now, I can't claim I named it, but I was there for the conversation that actually did name it. Because at the time, I had a bit of a joke going in my head, which was that the Beatles songs were all wrong. They were all wrong because the Beatles, they are a group, so therefore they should never use the personal pronoun I. All their songs should be we. We want to be your men. Everybody's got something to hide except for us and our monkeys. And then this was the one that was my suggestion for his podcast. We are the walruses. And Chris immediately replied, no, I am the egg pod. And it was like, bang, there you go, there's the name. That's how he got the name. Right, I'll do the next page. Anyway, I've been so happy to play a small role in this podcast from the start, seeing it grow from a tiny seed to the extraordinary thing it is today. But all great things have to have a full stop. All art has to end. But it hasn't ended yet. We've got this show, and Chris has made a great show for you. But before we see all that, I want to say thank you, Chris. And I want you to say as one, thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
And that's all. Drink up that applause, it's all for me. Right. right, and now I want to do a little bit of admin, because you see that recorder there? I'm recording the show for Chris. It's obviously being recorded properly through wires, but what he's asked me to do, he's asked me to come round the audience in like half time and a bit after the show and get a little bit of vox popping from the people here today. So he's got an audio record of the thing he's been part of, but also if it comes out well, he could use it as a bit of bonus content so everyone could hear it. So what I want you to do in preparing your own heads is for when I speak to you in half time, if you get the chance, two things. It's like, what does EggPod mean to you? And also, if you've personally kind of always thought, oh, I really want to be on EggPod, you've probably got your little Beatles theory in your head. What is your Beatles theory? Do it in 60 seconds, then we can all hear them. That's what I want to do. Right, okay, so the last bit is, today is not a wake, it's not a funeral, it's a celebration of life. On stage now, let's give it up for Chris Shaw! Chris fucking Shaw!
We'll start in about 10 minutes. So thank you everybody for the last ever EggPod. Gosh, can't believe it. It's the 60th anniversary today, 6th of July, 1964, of the world premiere of A Hard Day's Night. And, I've just been put off because I'm looking at in a good way. So we're going to be celebrating that. As well as that, it's the last day of whatever, so thank you for coming. Here comes the sun, I said it would, and it's here, and we're all together. So should we just get on with it? Introduce the guests. First of all, Mr. Stuart McCurdy!
Sorry about the delay. There were some problems. I'm hoping they've been sorted out. But yeah, Hard Day's Night is the 60th anniversary of the premiere at London Pavilion. So the first question is, when did you first see the movie?
Oh, wow. I'm unprepared for this. I guess on the telly at some time in the 70s, I would have thought. There may be people here who can tell me exactly when it first was on television.
1979.
Well, I guess it might be then. Christmas 1979. That feels a bit late. Yeah, that feels a bit late. So I'm guessing I might have had it. You know,
there's no pressure. It's just Martin Lewis and.
I was going to say. Well, it may have been then, but in my mind, I feel like it's like one of those things you think you've always known it since you were a child. I won't go into again. Like I said last time, that one of my earliest memories is being at a Beatles show in Wigan, which Mark told me and sent me pictures of, which sadly I've yet to find myself on them. But I think in my mind it's been the sort of thing I've always known. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
About 2 years ago, because I'm so incredibly young.
Sam, did you see it on TikTok?
Yeah, I watched it in 3-minute segments on my phone. No, because it kind of became contraband and disappeared, and then, you know, quality issues, and then, you know, it was available in a format that you didn't have in your house, and so eventually I think I watched it on Daily Motion, because that was where you could get it. And weirdly, I'd always loved the album, and it never occurred to me to watch the film that went with it. And thankfully, it wasn't disappointing. I saw it and was like, this is really brilliant. One of those rare things in life that really worth the wait.
Absolutely.
David?
I have no idea. I do remember that once I was listening to the radio, the Light programme, and they played Hello Dolly by Louis Armstrong. And the reason I mentioned this is that then followed it with Hard Day's Night. And that's my first memory of radio, my first memory of hearing the Beatles, and obviously hearing Hello Dolly, and that's been a big influence on my life. So if we're here to talk about the musicals of Michael Crawford, then I can't, I mean...
Like, David's going straight from here to a Louis Armstrong podcast live recording. Yeah,
it's, I tell you, it's just, it's called What a Wonderful World. It's just the best. So if I'm honest, my first memory of Hard Day's Night visually is the VHS. Mm. So I have no idea. I probably saw it on telly because I saw the Magical Mystery Tour when it was repeated, and I saw Let It Be, the famous, oh my God, it's so awful, bleak screening of whenever it was, 1979. Do they just show all the Beatles albums in one go? I mean, videos.
Yeah, films. Well, it was the Samir Hussain. I'm just interested, actually, because there's a lot of people who are going to be similar age. Who... Was that your first appearance where they showed all of the Beatles films in the Christmas of 79?
Yeah, this is ringing a bell, really.
One or two. Yeah, yeah, some hands going up. Yeah, that was, and it was like an onslaught of Beatles all over Christmas. And then you thought, oh, okay, I've got all this to do.
What took them so long? I mean, you know, they were quite popular, you know.
I think Apple Corp were going, I think if we hang around long enough, a format's going to be invented, which means you can monetize video.
Yeah, yeah.
I did once meet somebody from Parlophone. I said, I'm sorry to hear that Neil Aspinall's died, and his response was not enthusiastic.
Really?
About various things. But it's bizarre. I mean, the thing, of course, you have to remember, I hear people say this, like, why? But you have to remember, the BBC was just alternating The Great Escape and The Sound of Music every Christmas, and the Beatles aren't in either of those. I checked.
Mal is, but he has a little cameo.
Oh, yeah. Mal is in The Sound of Music as one of the Nazis.
Yeah,
which
he is.
Weird.
He's one of the Nazis.
He's carrying some machine guns.
When they go, come Ed. Yeah. Come Ed, you Nazis.
It's like Mal Evans is in the room.
Like Norman Rossington's in the room.
So I've asked our guests today to pick their favourite moments from the film. And hopefully there'll be some of yours as well, but definitely some of mine. So whoever wants to start, Lawrence, I think you...
I mean, really, really Route 1 approach to this, but the very beginning. We won't do this throughout, we won't just go with every scene in chronological order. Because it's an amazing high-energy opening to a film, it's a brilliant chord and a great song. But also, I think particularly because, obviously they're shooting this in largely chronological order, and I think I'm right in saying the Beatles were signed to Equity that morning on their way to,
yes.
Yeah, on their way to film the first scene. So some of the opening scenes arguably isn't the greatest acting known to man. And I love them, I say that with love, but to kind of, you're trying to buy into this sense of like verite and authenticity and originality when you're not gonna get brilliant performances immediately. One of the best things you can do is just have one of them fall over and you go, yeah, this is real. And then everyone goes down. I think I counted, including George and Ringo. It's like the opening of Private Ryan. There's like
you go on without me, Ringo.
Yeah. I mean, they really take out some kids. There's a great drinking game to be invented where you shoot all the school children as they come through onto the train platform. But it's just so much energy in it.
But I find that bit, it is, but I do find it hard to watch because of that, because George's fall looks so painful, doesn't it? He doesn't just kind of stumble, he goes right down like a ton of bricks, like face first. So you're always, a bit like you're always you know, you always watch John Lennon nervously thinking, is he going to do the face? You do though, don't you? You never feel comfortable. You never feel comfortable watching him. And at the beginning of our distance, I was like, for me, thinking he's going to fall in a minute, he's going to fall in a minute.
I think particularly me, because I watched it quite late at this age, you know, when someone goes down, you go, oh, that's going to break something. But the Beatles were young enough to bounce.
Yeah,
it was an amazing moment. I heard that George wouldn't fall over, so Richard Lester just shouted, "My Sweet Lord's got the same tune as He's So Fine," and he just went down.
They spend an awful lot of the film running. You notice that? They run an awful lot in the film, yeah. They've got their bases in, definitely.
The whole thing of, like, it was like the Marx Brothers. I mean, the Marx Brothers never move that fast.
No.
It's brilliant, and obviously, just the whole energy. It's the best opening. It's, just to repeat what Lauren said, it's the opening chord, the music, and just the running, and the whole gag thing of running through cars and train compartments and running. And the whole, that's what the film about. There is no plot. Two men go missing. That's not a plot.
Well, in the script, there's a big chunk that's not in there where they sort of stop and plug in and play a gig on the platform. But the actual opening sequence is five lines, which is sort of, they run up to a station, they go through the barriers, the kids try and get pennies out to get through the barriers, and then they get to the train. And that's it. So it's all kind of, you know, Dick Lester and the Beatles working a sequence out of that. So, and you feel it, you know, it feels really sort of live. And so, I mean, the other thing that struck me was seeing it as a little bit of archaeology, and, you know, that he's getting milk out of a milk machine, which is something I never knew existed. And then, and because it's all, you know, because the Beatles are rock and roll and pop culture, and, you know, we've still got Beatles headlining Glastonbury and new songs coming out, they sort of feel still in some ways so current. And then I realised that one of those awful things that happen when you start to look relatively at eras, that in 2 years' time, the release of this film will be as far from now as it was from Queen Victoria. Oh, I'm really sorry I did that to everyone. I'm sorry.
Thanks for that.
It's a fact. I picked the opening as well, for all the same reasons that Lawrence is saying. But there's a great story. Dick Lester tells a great story about the premiere. Because if you were at the premiere, you didn't enjoy any of this. Because they had an organist at the premiere playing jaunty versions. And I thought this is correct. Playing jaunty versions of, this is what Dick Lester says, of jaunty versions of Beatles tunes. Who didn't leave in time. So the film begins with that great opening, but no chord. All you're hearing if you're in the premiere is Hard Day's Night played on an organ. And eventually, I think several minutes in, the organist disappears and you catch up with the film. But the audience on the opening night didn't see that great opening. Well, they saw it, but they couldn't hear anything.
There's always one, isn't there? Whenever you go to the cinema, he won't stop playing the organ or eating sweets or talking to his mate.
Yeah. But as you say, the plot is threadbare, to say the least. I mean, Lawrence, I think pretty well a caveman could probably summarise.
I think he would have had a crack. I mean, that's kind of the point of it, though, that it feels... I like how loose it feels, because I think to try and capture that energy and the sort of lovable amateurishness of it, it's not like they're trying to give polished performances. One of the other sort of favourite moments in it is Ringo's line in the train where he says, "Well, he's your grandfather, who knows?" Ha ha ha. Which is simultaneously the best and the worst and the greatest and the funniest. And I every time I watch it, I feel completely different about it.
Yeah.
It's such a bizarre delivery.
It is. It's somewhat they didn't say, "Can we do that again?" It's not.
I want, because I suppose there's no, you know, it's a sales ploy for an album, and it. I don't think when they were making it, even though obviously everyone involved, particularly Dick Lester, wanted to make the best version, the best film he possibly could, it's a sales ploy for an album. And I suppose if they'd have known that there would still be podcasts, if they'd have known that podcasts would be a thing and that there would be one about it 60 years later, they might have gone, "Ringo, could you do that line again?" But in the script, you see that dot, 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 that's a pause.
Yeah.
I love that.
There are pauses in the line in the script, and then it says afterwards in brackets, "The lads all laugh." Come on, guys.
Yes.
Everyone join in. Don't leave him out there like that.
I love that scene because it's the first scene filmed with dialogue. It's the first moment, if you don't count like Morecambe and Wise and Ken Dodd sketches, where the Beatles have acted in front of a camera. And instantly, their personalities come out. Ringo is, as you say, insane. He's actually more like Ringo in the American cartoon, which is quite weird. George is kind of mildly sardonic. John goes, yeah, he doesn't do the face, but he's full-on weird, sarcastic bit of goo. And Paul is just trying to impress. It's Dirk McQuickley. He's going, ooh, he's my granddad, combs his hair, puts on a false beard, poses with a skull, does a bit of tattoos.
Wilfred Bramble.
And Wilfred Bramble is Wilfred Bramble.
Oh, we'll get on to Wilfred Bramble in a bit.
Get on to Wilfred Bramble.
The elephant in the room that is the tiny Wilfred Bramble, yeah.
I did always wonder about Paul in that opening, because again, in the script, it's sort of all the four boys together, and at what point he went, I think I can do a whole bit on my own, a little sketch, and I'll wear some facial hair, and I'll do the old gag with the newspaper, and Dick Lester going, okay, try it.
Yeah, Paul is trying very, very hard. Overly hard.
One thing I don't like, and I noticed I watched it recently on DVD and then again last night on iPlayer, and it's slightly different. I don't know if they're remasterings, different masterings, or is I don't like the fact that one of the bits of the early Beatles I really love is the end of the actual song, A Hard Day's Night, because you see an example of the genius, which is, I think, how the song ends with suddenly a new thing that takes you somewhere else. You know, the arpeggio, and it seems to be the song is going on somewhere else. It continues in another dimension or in another place. That's a very early example of a genius, but they can cut it really short.
And Dick Lester was there in the studio and said two things. He wanted that big, long, big chord at the beginning and kept saying, more, bigger, can you add anything to it? And he wanted this dreamlike fade-out at the end, which they did, and then he cut it.
And he cut it.
Which is why I won't watch Superman 2.
But that arpeggio at the end is actually... the opening chord played as an arpeggio. They are all the notes in the opening chord.
But it does have the sound of suddenly a new song is starting, but you're not going to get to hear it because it's somewhere else in the big universe. Yeah.
I mean, George Martin, I mean, it was all very quickly done. I mean, I've got a quote here, but I'm not very good at George Martin impressions, but Kevin Eldon, would you pop up for a second?
I didn't expect that. By all means, I'd be quite prepared for that eventuality.
Your grandfather, yeah. It's absolutely brilliant. Okay, here's a quote from George. quite a long one. I have a definite outlook on music. There are only two kinds, good or bad. And the Beatles' music is good, and there's an awful lot of bad classical music. Now, I thought I'd better study guitar, because the boys can't read or write music. So I have to interpret everything for them. They get the basic idea, they play it to me on the guitar, sing it, and at that stage, we get down to it in the studio with what we call a head arrangement. We talk about it and knock it around until we get what we want. The script attempts to overcome the old problem of a musical film, how to introduce it naturally. As John remarked, and I won't do the accent, it seems soft just to break into a number complete with guitars and drums, particularly on a train. It just doesn't happen like that. We had 7 studio sessions in 3 days. We worked long days, but at the end we had the lot done. John and Paul wrote all the new numbers while they were in London, Paris, New York. Pop music. And Miami. We worked so fast that one of the numbers wasn't even finished when the boys arrived at the studio for the recording. And we put our heads together and finished it on the spot. Fuck the Tories.
George Martin's language is disgraceful. Thank you.
You never struck me as a real Tory hater. I don't know, maybe it's the voice.
David, you picked quite a few things that you enjoyed. Reminder.
It's a great film. Weirdly, one of the things I picked ended up in a Pet Shop Boys lyric this year, which I completely forgot to write down. Sorry?
Isn't it on Loneliness?
It's on the single Loneliness, came out 2024, and it's a line like Ringo by the side of the canal. And it is just, it's one of the great moments. As we all know, Ringo, I mean, it's a great idea. Let's give everyone their individual bit, and they all get little sardonic, sort of satirical moments throughout the film. But Ringo just gets a bit, he walks by a canal, and everyone laughs at him, and loads of people are rude to him, and a child is his friend. And it's lovely, and he makes things fall over and throws a stone. And it's an absolute, apparently he had an absolutely brain-wrecking hangover that morning, which adds a new dimension to it. And what's lovely as well, of course, it's the start of his movie career. He was basically the only Beatle who could act for Toffee, and that is reflected in this moment. It's a fantastic sequence. He's a great movie clown. He's always got pathos.
I would say George is my favourite.
You would say that, yes.
I would say that. But, yeah, I think he gives... I think Dick Lester said he gave a more honest performance. I mean, none of them could act. Ringo, probably the best actor. But, yeah, for me, George, especially on the train at the beginning.
Yeah. It's interesting, I suppose, the fact that it's so much of it's filmed in sequence that you literally see them learning how to act as you watch the film. And by about 40 minutes in, you go, there you go.
Yeah.
And they've kind of got into their stride. There's some great stuff, you know. I thought, we're now going to go through and individually defend all of the Beatles' acting. But, you know, we started. So, yes, Ringo's very good. George's very good. I think John and his little sketch with Millie, which, like so many films and things in the film, completely lifts out and doesn't need to be there, but I love, because it's the shape of a really fun sketch. And no matter how many times you watch it, you can't track the internal logic. And I love that about it, where he simultaneously proves that he is and isn't John Lennon, yeah, by suggesting that the woman he's talking to both has and hasn't slept with John Lennon, and then realises, therefore, he can't be. Yeah. And, it's a great little weird comic conceit.
Because, as you said, you would think that Paul... You know, just because of what we know, the history of what we know about Paul, and his seemingly superhuman facility to do anything, that he would be the best actor. But the reason you were saying earlier, the reason his cameo's not in, was filmed then dropped, is because he was the worst. So,
it's interesting when you look at their subsequent career. You've got like Ringo, loads and loads of bits in movies, most of them terrible, but he's really good in them. John, pretty good, actually, in How I Won the War. I still quote the line where, sorry, spoiler, Lennon is killed and says, I knew this would happen, and then looks at the camera and says, I believe you knew this would happen too. It's still one of my, you know, it's not a line you get to use very often unless you've been shot in the stomach. But, and George is very good in his brief cameo in The Ruttles.
Yeah, and Life of Brian.
And Life of Brian, and Paul is absolutely shocking. Give my regards to Broad Street.
We do not say those words.
He's actually good in Rupert.
Yeah.
Yes. Got to give him that. He's very good as Rupert Bear in Rupert the Video.
I really love the frog song, but you can't say that, can you?
You can in here.
It's a frog song.
Good!
I am going to say this, though, and this is something that really burns me up. There's a bit in the frog song where Windsor Davis is playing an older frog, and his son frog, I think that's the term, says to him, he says something, he's being annoying, and Windsor Davis says, son, if you don't behave, I won't bring you back next time they have this event in 200 years. And he completely blows the timing of the line. Right. When you get home, go and watch it. Or now.
Ringo's watched that and said the timing's fine on that line.
We're having this brief frog chorus digression. I know several people in Liverpool who insist, and I don't know if I've mentioned this before, that the frog chorus is about the miners' strike.
Wow.
Seriously, because did he come out roughly at the same time? And I have friends in the police say it's clearly, we all stand together, it's clearly a pro-miners song.
84.
I've yet to see any interview evidence of it.
It's certainly not an anti-miners song.
No, we know.
No one can say that. Wait, there is that bit at the start where someone says, stuff you, Arthur Scoggins.
Yeah,
Badger says that, who clearly represents Thatcher.
There's always some insight in Eggpod. I think, talking of characters, we've got Norman Rossington playing Norm.
Yeah.
And Shake as well, John Junkin.
Who was It was loosely supposed to be Neil and Mal, aren't they?
Yeah, well, in the original screenplay, I'm going to have to stand up for this. In the original screenplay, or one of the original screenplays, because Mark Lewis is looking at me, Norm's name was Nell,
which
as
was
is the nickname for Neil Aspinall. Yeah. And Shake's name was Mal. Mal Evans.
It's a bit on the nose, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, but like Norm, you can kind of understand why he was called Norm. Could you hold this mic?
Yeah, of course.
This is so exciting. This is going to be great on a podcast.
We haven't rehearsed this bit.
No. Chris is now changing into a bear costume. With antlers.
So, Shake. Yeah. But why was Mal Evans called Shake? Possibly.
Oh. This is like
Mumbles. I don't know. But it's a thought.
It's up there with Paul's dead as theories go.
Yeah. Yes. Evans is Shake. So,
while speaking about John Junkin, can I say that one of my favourite ever lines about inspiration in writing comes from the great John Junkin. When someone asked him where he got the inspiration for his comedy, he said, I put a blank sheet of paper in the typewriter and I put my gas bill next to the typewriter.
I would just like to say at this point that John Junkin was in a radio show called Hello Cheeky with Barry Cryer and Tim Brooke Taylor, and honestly, that makes them the Beatles of comedy,
as far as I'm concerned.
A goodie, a Barry Cryer and John Junkin. It's extraordinary. Yeah, it's great casting. To have those two as the voice of sanity and rudeness throughout the story, and as a contrast to all the middle-class figures they keep meeting, is brilliant.
And John Junkin's accent... This is weird. This thing. I mean, Norman Rossington is a Scouser, isn't he? And John Junkin isn't. But John Junkin manages to sound it's a more natural Scouse accent that John Junkin does than Norman Rossington's comedy Scouser, isn't it? It's weird, yeah.
Well, I think he introduced himself with that accent.
Yeah.
Checking. And to sort of ingratiate them. And they don't think they're aware that he wasn't a Scouser originally. And it's incredible. You know, if you're from Liverpool, don't do Liverpool accents to people from Liverpool, as you'll find out later. So, I think, Stuart, you've also picked Lennon Coke bottle sniffing.
Well, I just find that fascinating, the sniffing the Coke bottle scene, because we're talking the spring of 1964. Now, I'm trying to think of the Beatles' drug experiences up to this date. Again, there'll be people in this audience working on a PhD about the Beatles and their drug habits. But we all know about the Prellies in Hamburg and he's so keen, you can tell, to get that joke in, isn't he? He keeps doing it till he catches the camera. But it's a joke about taking cocaine, but haven't they just started smoking dope at this point?
If there had been a soft drink called dope, he probably would have found a gag.
So it's just interesting where it sits in how much experience of cocaine did they have?
It's because he was from the future.
Okay.
Obviously.
I mean, maybe when you talk to Mark and Smear in the second half, you can bring this up again. But it just seems, you know, unless my Beatles drug chronology is very much out, it's interesting.
Lawrence, you've also put Can't Buy Me Love and the word joyous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it is. It's brilliant. And again, in the script, it's nothing. It's just, you know, they just go outside and almost entirely improvise. And I always loved it because I found it initially as though it was a video, and it feels like it's a music video. I didn't see it in the context of the film when I first saw it. And this is a year before Subterranean Homesick Blues, you know, which people sort of say, oh, well, is that the first music video? And this is part of a narrative, obviously, but when you look at it in isolation, it's so great, and it's so full of energy. And we got, when we did Horrible Histories, we got to do a kind of Beatles / Monkees pastiche of ancient Greek philosophers. I mean, you know, everyone's had that idea.
Was it called Hey Hey We're the Thinkers?
Hey Hey We're the Thinkers.
Hey Hey We're the Thinkers.
Yeah. But we also, we got to do it, we were filming at Twickenham Studios in the stage where years later, and only found out later that the park that was 10 minutes away from the studio I also went to universities. This was at Twickenham Studios, and I went to university in Twickenham. They knocked it down now, along with all three houses I lived in, which I've chose not to see a connection.
I feel this is becoming a bitter person.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I didn't have the brain
over there. Bedsit.
But I used to go walking around the park in Isleworth because it was near my university, and I only found out subsequently that that's the park where they went and filmed that whole video. Yeah, you wouldn't recognise it today. It's very beautiful, though, now. Not as barren.
I was just trying to think of Greek philosophy Beatles puns, and I'm ashamed to say that all I can think of is Socrates a woman.
Which that's is really bad. Bad. Try not to say anything else for a while, David. That's really bad.
There's a Plato.
I was... I was Diogenes and also Ringo, which I did in a very bad Scouse accent. I think he'd have been proud. Ringo, not yeah. Diogenes. Diogenes. Diogenes would not approve of anything we did.
David, such as your notes were... Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Lawrence, for your in-depth notes.
What is David, this, an exam?
Shame him!
Your note two is just
you
two
just
words.
You just drew a willy and wrote Ringo next to it.
Yeah. And next spelled to the, Ringo wrong.
Yeah, next to the willy, you've written... Well, oh, that's bad timing. Very clean.
Oh, yeah. You can say what you like about David Quanting.
I don't care. Very clean.
So I don't know if you were boasting.
Obviously very clean is the reference to Wilfred Bramble's character throughout, but really it's kind of reminded to me to basically the surrealism of the language in this. Alan Owen's script, is what I love is the way that he's caught the spirit of the Beatles, the John Lennon in his own right, so the private language, the fact that Ringo said things like, it's been a hard day's night, a completely weird British goon shows Alec Lewis Carroll surrealism that doesn't copy the way the Beatles talk, that doesn't overdo it, but all the way through there's this strange language that makes the film unique. It makes it not Catch Us If You Can, makes it not Summer Holiday, because it's based on... Sorry, there's been some assassinations.
We did warn you about the gunshot outside.
From some of the lines, I'm going to just blow my bit now. It's just like... There's a line when Paul says something about to Shake. You know, have you kept an eye on my grandfather? Will he run away? And Shake says, and I quote, don't worry, I've bound him to me with promises. Yeah. It's like, what the hell? And, the famous turn left at Greenland line, which, by the way, just a forward quote, if you've ever seen the film Stardust, not featuring Ringo. It's a great moment when they're doing a press conference. David Essex is being asked questions, and the rest of the band, who at this point hate him, say, at least he didn't say, turn left at Greenland.
Would now be the right time to address the Wilfred Bramble issue? Yeah. I don't know how other people feel about this. I feel that you could take Wilfred Bramble out of the movie entirely with no loss of enjoyment whatsoever.
It's controversial.
I find his every appearance... creepy, unfunny, except for the one bit with the weird bit where he goes into Irish republicanism in the clock shop. That is the only, because you just watch that and go, what is this now about Fenians and the black and tans? What is this coming from? But apart from that, I just felt, the casino scene, just you would have just been.
It's just that thing like the White Album with people go, it'd actually be really good if you just remove Revolution Number 9 and Wild Honey Pie.
No, but
it's part of the film.
They dropped a bit with Paul McCartney to keep that bit, the really sub Benny Hill stuff in the casino.
You should see the version in the script of the casino scene is longer and more carry on. So that is after a bit of judicious chopping, they've ended up with that. It was interesting, the whole very clean thing. I mean, one, as a running gag, if you play that to a modern audience, without any context, you go, why do they keep saying the creepiest old man I've ever seen is so clean?
Exactly.
And you go, it's because at the time he played a dirty old man. Yeah. But also, you know, in the...
I get it now.
But also, you know, in the legal context of the time, you know, he was cast a year after being put up before the courts, and sort of almost getting away, but also being charged with persistently opportuning for a moral purpose, which is what they called hanging around park toilets at the time.
And so it's sort of interesting of going, I would do this part in your film, but can you repeatedly say I'm clean and ideally have me womanising?
Yeah.
So maybe it was, there were some caveats in the cast.
The other thing about the whole Wilfred Bramble, the grandfather plot, is that the whole plot of the film is someone goes missing. So to introduce a plot strand which is someone else goes missing,
yeah,
it's a bit like, and also because it's not that important. Because it's like, the Ringo thing is great. What's the whole plot of the show? What's the aim of the aim of the film is the Beatles play a gig. That's the whole plot. Get them to the church on time. Get them here to here. Ringo goes missing. Paul's granddad goes missing. Well, yeah, he was old. You know, drag him out of the Thames. Who's going to miss him? Nobody. That woman who was good at swimming, she might miss him.
But they I think Dick Lester talked about them and Alan being in a hotel room in Paris and working on the script, and which would mean it was like mid to end of January, and they start filming on the 2nd of March, which kind of brings me out in hives that they're like, we'll come up with a story at some point.
And the songs.
Yeah, I know. I mean, crazy.
One thing, it's slightly off topic, but another thing amazes me is, if I'm right in thinking, we were just chatting about this earlier, there's about 3 weeks between Ed Sullivan and Miami and this. Literally, there's about 3 weeks. So that gives you an idea of how quick the Beatles are moving and how quick the Beatles are changing the world, like day by day, almost. But also, there seem to be things in Hard Day's Night that reflect the experiences of 3 weeks ago, which I don't know if they were very late additions by Alan Owen or they were in price, because there's that whole bit where there's a press conference routine, isn't there, where they're giving flip, witty answers in the reception, which does seem to me to be nodding towards their recent fame as this, you know, the press conferences in America. So I don't know how late things were being done, but just, I mean, can you imagine that? They've done Red Sullivan, they've been on holiday in Miami, you know, and then they get back, they've got a couple of weeks, and they're making Hard Day's Night.
Can you think of the gulf between the moment where they agreed to do this film and then the context in which they were shooting it?
Yeah.
And the difference in their popularity. I mean, Beatlemania has suddenly exploded between them going, would you do this little thing to help publicise this album? And what it then became, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so many things. It's a tidal wave. It changes movies, it changes rock movies, because as we all know, there's that great story that the Beatles go to a drive-in in the United States in some mysterious point, and there's a Cliff movie on, and it's like third on the bill, and they realise that absolutely no one in the world gives a toss about Cliff Richard and the entire British rock scene and movies, and that's they change everything. Hard Day's Night is, when you look at a piece of rubbish like Help, controversial, which changes nothing apart from people's attitudes to Leo McKern. That was the aim. But yeah, Hard Day's Night is, things get so much forgotten because Sgt. Pepper's so important and Let It Be so, and all this stuff. But Hard Day's Night is such, it's the first great Beatles album. It's got all the original songs on it. It's got loads of ideas, which don't have to do anything with playing tapes backwards. Sorry, Kevin. But all that kind of thing. It's just because it's a collection of incredibly good, world-changing songs. And the movie adds to that.
To a point we all know, pop movies before that had been, you know, kind of cheesy and kind of, this is the first one to adopt this kind of cool, slightly odd, slightly surreal, slightly sardonic tone. I think in much the same, that changes the way movies look, pop movies look, in the same way that Astrid's pictures from Hamburg, I think, change the way bands are photographed. Before that, bands would tend to be photographed like this, and suddenly, Don't Smile, stand, sit on a piece of machinery. There's a direct line between that and Kevin Cummins' Joy Division pictures. You know, aren't they? They are the progenitors of that, really. But it also, it's as much about, Hard Day's Night becomes as much about the relationship between the Beatles and the wider culture and the media and the press as it is about the Beatles and their music. So some of my favourite scenes are like, you know, the Victor Spinetti stuff and the Kenneth Hague stuff. So Kenneth Hague,
yes.
Kenneth Hague, who plays that kind of weird, he's a sort of advertising executive slash, there's a bit of Larry Parnes and a bit of advertising executive in there. And you see in that, that's such a brilliant piece of satire. This is the world that the Beatles are hopefully going to change. And these people who treat them as exotic creatures, as idiots, working class idiots, exotic creatures, you know, who don't get them at all, really. But and Kenneth Hague, interestingly, I think, who was later became, was it Room at the Top he was in the TV series?
He was doing Caligula, wasn't he?
He was a very well-respected Shakespearean actor at the time who, I think I'm right saying, didn't want his name on the credits. Didn't want his name on the credits because he felt this ephemeral bit of beat music rubbish, he wouldn't want that on his CV in years to come. Of course, within 2 years, he's telling everybody, of course I'm in Hard Day's Night, darling. You know, have you seen me in Hard Day's Night? I'm marvellous, you know.
What I love about that scene particularly, because I was watching the DVD extras instead of doing any research, and discovered that he was actually in a big Shakespeare play, one of the famous ones, which explains his slightly bizarre haircut.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, it's a really in-60s joke. No, he's just got one of them crap Hamlet haircuts.
Yeah. When you look at everyone else in it, you go, oh, no, that's definitely a Roman era haircut.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, oh, it's Roman haircut.
Oh, okay. Oh, I mean, immediately, I can pick any haircut out of any historical.
More Vespasian than the earlier emperors, but yeah, possibly post-Constantine. Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Around that era. One of my favourite bits about that scene is the very first shot of George going in there, which is, if nothing is more 1963 than a man with a mop top hair going in and saying a sexist comment to a woman on a ring dial telephone smoking a cigarette. It's kind of like ultimate 1963 bingo.
I will take issue with Wilfred Bramble, because I think Norman Rossington's even more annoying.
Oh, I think you might be right. I literally went through and counted. There is one occasion, I think, when he doesn't say come out. I think there's only one when he gets to the sentence.
And it's certainly in the draft of the script I've read, it's not in there. So he decided.
So he decided.
I've got this thing, I'm going to do this thing. No. Oh, he's done it.
When I saw it in that weird kind of mixed up chronology thing, because he keeps saying come out, I think, oh my God, he's just seen too many early Brooksides.
Well,
no,
you're right, Norman Rossington.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we slag off then, who previously was thought to be great in this film?
But they're crucial to the film. I mean, Norman Rossington is adding even more pressure to them. And yeah, I know Wilfred is kind of taking it in another direction.
Yeah.
But it is all about the pressure, isn't it? I think they were the best thing about the bit in the field. A lot of the films that were filmed in small, deliberately, like The Cage, when they're doing Should Have Known Better. But they're always enclosed and they're always trapped. So that when they escape, we're out.
Yeah,
just in
We're Out is a great moment. Ringo shouting that. Yeah. And the helicopter at the end, the sort of like the Charlie Bubbles style vague escape.
Yes.
It's like they're meant to be escaping. You know they're actually going to another appointment. Yes. And that they will be trapped forever.
Well, that was like the end of, which is, I don't think this would exist in the same way. I think Chris Chibnall, you're here somewhere, I don't know.
Hello.
We did the Maisels Brothers documentary, and there's so much in here that is directly from that.
Well, it looked to me, am I completely wrong in thinking, is Victor Spinetti's jumper a deliberate echo of Murray the K's jumper in the Maisels documentary, or am I getting too into the Beatles?
We have hands up on this, so it won't be on the podcast. Who thinks Stuart is reading too much into Victor Spinetti's jumper? Okay. And who thinks he's bang on?
Well, I just happen to have with me tonight. No, I think, I just thought, well, because I've been watching a lot of the Maisels Brothers doc and Murray the K, but he's a whole other story, Murray the K, but anyway, yeah.
I love that thing about Victor Spinetti, that he just basically decided his whole character note was, they're going to be late, because it's just this horrible, trembling, suspended
thing. I think he's great. I think Victor Spinetti is great. I would have liked more of Victor Spinetti and less of Wilfred Bramble. When he there's a great bit where he deadpans something like, and can you get them to come? And if they don't, I shall strike them. Doesn't he say something like that at one point?
I shall strangle him.
Oh, right.
He's great, and the fact that he turns up in Magical Mystery Tour as the complete opposite character, Sergeant Major from, I think it's Oh What Lovely War is where he played it first. Yeah, I mean, Victor Spinetti is one of the great unseen fifth-esque Beatles.
Yeah.
David Barry, stand up. David Barry was in Please Sir as Frankie Abbott. Now, and knows, I guess it's coming later, but if you speak to him during the break, he'll tell you his Victor Spinetti story, which we can't tell here because there's some children, but that's who you need to ask. You must be
I'm
very
quite prepared to send my children out of the room right now to hear this story.
It's incredible.
Incredible. That's a very high guy.
Oh, I'll tell you in a bit. Moving on.
Is it Bob Dylan going round to Dave Stewart's house? Oh. Incredible.
More so. John saying, can we have our ball back? David's written.
The whole, because it's the authority thing. It's a funny line. Just treating authority with total disrespect. Apparently the scene where the posh guy Watson closes the window without asking them and all that was based on real things that had happened to the Beatles. And it is that thing that it's a not in your face class film like everything with Albert Finney was at that point. But it is a film about class. It is saying just because all these people who we're supposed to respect, just because they have a bowler hat and a moustache, you know, doesn't make them better than us.
Well, it's like that line of George, isn't it? Sorry we hurt your field, mister.
When they come. Such a great line.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, the brilliant surrealist moment when the Richard Lester Goons connection comes in and they are somehow cycling past a moving train.
Yeah.
And he is being trolled by Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
I love with all of the effort to make it feel real that suddenly you'll go, and then they'll just on bikes outside and John Lennon can disappear from a bath and just sort of did these left turns into these moments of surrealism and then back into the tone of the rest of the film.
The Lennon in the bath scene is interesting as well because you realise how we're not that far away from the Second World War and there is still such a trope in the culture to do funny German accents, funny Nazis, funny U-boat jokes. In a way, it's kind of still going on for another 20 years. I think, has it gone now? Has it receded from the culture?
No, but I don't tend to do it if I can avoid it.
I think
it's frowned upon.
Yeah, I think exactly. But you realise then it was still so much. And then it's interesting because you think, and they were in Hamburg not that long ago. You know, it's all tied up with them. It's all little lines in a way.
Isn't there a line doing it in Hamburg as well on stage?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Isn't there a line where somebody says, "I fought in the war," and somebody said, "Bet you're sorry you won"?
Ringo says it to the posh guy in the train carriage.
Yeah.
It's a great line.
Although Ringo says it, "I'm sorry you won."
Richard Vernon, he was 39 years old.
Which was
more worrying.
39.
Wilfred Bramble was 3 years older than me playing Paul's granddad. I find that horribly offensive.
How old is Bramble, as I like to call him then?
Wilfred Bramble was 7 when that film was made. Richard Vernon hadn't even been born. Everyone was old in those days. Imagine now, people from the past desperately trying to find someone their own age. They'd look around this room and go, "Oh my God, it's a kindergarten." It's just a load of sperm looking for ova. Wish I hadn't said that. And now back to the Beatles.
Stuart, on your notes you've written one word, prisoners.
Prisoners. Prisoners, which is the only word allowed to any of the schoolgirls in the scene. Another scene now that I think we call it problematic these days, don't we?
Yeah.
The let's go and try and tap up, as they would have said, the schoolgirls on the play. But Patty Boyd gets the one word, prisoners, which is just, I just think it's interesting because that's where Patty and George meet, perhaps taken by her acting. She was in that because she'd recently been a TV hit in a Crisp Smiths commercial, so she was quite, she'd been one on TV Viewers at the time. And she is quite, she's, what I like about the casting is she's not an incredibly glamorous looking girl. She's quite unusual looking. George is very taken by her. Apparently they all were hugely taken by her. But George initially, I think, says that day when they meet, "Will you marry me?" And she says, "No." And she says, this is probably a well-known story, but and then he says, "Well, will you come out for dinner with me?" And she says, "Well, I can't because I've got a boyfriend."
And she says, "That won't be a problem." "Oh, your friends."
Exactly. She goes back to her mates and says, "Oh, one of the Beatles asked me out, but I can't because I'm a boyfriend." They go, "Are you mad?" So, 10 days later or something, they're doing a publicity shoot, aren't they, for the movies, where the girls are in again cutting, pretending to cut their hair. And by this time, Patty says, "Oh, by the way, the boyfriend's not around anymore, George." So they do. They go out to dinner at the Carlton Club, I think, or the Garrick. They go out to dinner at the Garrick. You forget how young they were. Epstein's there. Epstein chaperones them on their dinner date at the Garrick, Patty and George, and orders for them because they don't know their way around a menu. Because George doesn't know his way around a posh menu. So actually, that's both. It's so lovely, that image, and it's sweet and it's sad and it's funny. Epstein sort of sitting in the corner, chaproning these two young people and saying, "That's steak. You won't like that. It's medium rare, you know." And this, "I'll get the wine." It's just, it's that kind of sweet and bizarre, and you know.
What did they have?
Oh, I wish I could make something funny up on the spot now. I don't know. What would be a 1963 thing to have? They probably would have had. Steak Diane.
Doc à l'orange.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
That's what we had in the 60s. Actually, if there's anything like what we had in the 60s, they probably had spaghetti hooves.
I think if we learned anything from Get Back, they just had toast and tea.
Toast and tea, yes.
Sugar Smacks with a spaceman in.
Yeah, but yes.
Just say the life she could have had, because You know, all the increasingly bad songs written about Patty Boyd. Something.
Particularly in the 70s.
Layla, good riff. Wonderful Tonight. That must have done it for her. It's a low point in the world culture. All you can think to say about it is about the woman you love is that in the evening she dresses nice.
And I think only on one evening.
Yeah, you made the effort tonight, love.
Oh, tonight, yeah. Yesterday.
Disaster. I've got 364 other songs about how you looked on March the 28th.
March 28th. Weird trousers.
Also, of course, to be like analytical for a moment, also when she says prisoners, meaning that Paul's joking that they're prisoners, you know, from a prison, but when she says prisoners, but like, they are like prisoners?
Yes.
Yeah? Do you get it? Like, in a way, they are prisoners?
And also, if you go around chatting up schoolgirls, you know, at some point.
On April the 17th, I keep noticing that you had chosen green harem pants.
So we go through Eric Clapton's entire singles career now.
It's a riff that I can do throughout the show. Yeah.
It's a bit of business Dave does.
Always work.
So, we started a bit late, so we'll go a bit more. But I think let's sort of conclude for now. What does this film and the album mean to you?
I mean, I think to hell with these guys. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm profoundly jealous that either you go, you should have made an incredible album, but the film's not great. Or you make a great film, but it's not your best album. But both are really real high points. Yeah. And they absolutely complement each other. Like I say, coming to a film late, having seen some elements of it in isolation and thinking I'm just watching these early, really brilliantly produced proto-pop videos. Yeah. And also those accompanying really fantastic, you know, compositions, brilliant songwriting and brilliant production. It's just all so good so early in their career, you know. By the time we're looking at them again 5 years later, you go, you've got the experience for this to be that good, and that's fair enough, but they don't deserve to be making something that's brilliant. Everyone get a flyer!
Oh, if one of those photographs would fall down. As then once said, the album is just is fantastic, just a fantastic collection of brilliant songs, brilliantly played. We know they're going to go on to change the world with other things, but that's just a great album of great songs, brilliantly played. But I love about it, it captures that sense of the moment in time of the most, you know, Philip Norman's got this quote. I know in this room there'll be many people, you know, like me, who find Philip Norman problematic. But he said at one point, the greatest engine for human happiness that the entertainment world has ever produced. And you catch them at that moment. I think you catch them. You catch them in such a joy in each other's company. That's what I love. There are so many bits that clearly aren't scripted. There are just moments where they're in each other's company having fun. I love that when they do, see, I saw a standing that they do when George, it's clearly one of the ones where the audience isn't in. You can tell that, where the audience isn't in. And George starts to muck about, you know, and do a silly dance. They're just, you just, what must the world have been like for those four lads then, right then? They are changing the world with literally everything they do. Working class lads from Liverpool, the eyes of the world are on them, and they are changing the world with pretty much everything they do and say. It's just such a brilliant, and that sense comes roaring off the screen. And also the happy conjunction that, but Dick Lester, Alan Owen, I mean, people around them who got them, as well, and Mr. Shinson, the producer, who really got them as well, I think, and said, yeah, you know, to Dick Lester, yeah, you make that movie, that'll be great, you know, so I just think it's a wonderful, you know, the zeitgeist in the sense of the Beatles, the visceral thrill of the early Beatles is right there.
David. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with everybody. The short thing is the really simple answer. Hard Day's Night is the greatest pop album of all time, and Hard Day's Night is also the greatest pop movie of all time. And I will end my bit with an anecdote. In about 10 years ago, somebody went out and said to loads of famous people, we're doing an album called The Songs of Paul McCartney. The only criterion for inclusion on this album, it has to be a song that's a solo song by Paul or a Wings song. And loads of people, like Aerosmith, did a Wings song, and I don't know, somebody else, Peter Frampton, did a Paul McCartney song. Bob Dylan was approached. Do you know what non-Beatles song Bob Dylan sang? Things We Said Today from the album Hard Day's Night by the Beatles. That's how good Hard Day's Night is. It doesn't make sense as a story, but it does sound good, and that's a punchline.
So we're going to take a little break now. I think we start at 5:30, I think. People will tell you. So please, can we have a huge round of applause for our guests? Stuart McConey. Lawrence Ricard. And David Quantick. And we'll see you shortly.